Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with the schedule of English language broadcast, or it's simpler to use a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. You can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from France 24 and Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. I usually have a larger variety of stations and in fact have listened to and edited many more reports from other stations, but there were 2 stories that I felt were most important. We will begin with France 24. France has a weekly interview show called Tête-à-Tête, which goes in-depth on the subject. The host, Mark Perlman, interviewed Josh Paul, who served for 11 years in the U.S. State Department, overseeing weapons sales to foreign countries. He resigned in October to protest the sales to Israel as the war in Gaza raced ahead. The State Department announced Monday that U.S. weapons were used by 5 units of the Israeli Defense Force in gross violations of human rights. The U.S. Leahy Law prohibits the sale of weapons where they are used in such violations, like the murder of Palestinian-American press reporter Shirin Abu Akleh in May of 22. All of these named violations occurred well before the October 7th invasion of Gaza. No U.S. administration has ever curbed arms sales to Israel, despite it being against U.S. law. Josh says that there is a culture of fear in the State Department and that campus protest or response to concerns over the war just being brushed aside by government officials. Europe has also seen protests about the Israeli war on Palestine, and there is a debate ongoing right now at the Paris Institute of Political Studies in hopes of lessening forceful student uprisings in France. France 24.
Hello and welcome to Tête-à-Tête, France 24's flagship interview show. Our guest today is Josh Paul. He served for over a decade in the State Department overseeing weapons sales to foreign countries. He resigned in October to protest the U.S. position vis-a-vis Israel shortly into the war in Gaza. He has since joined the think tank Democracy for the Arab World Now, it's known as DAWN, as a fellow, and he's with us from Washington, D.C. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed for having me. Bonjour.
So you work 11 years as director in the State Department's Bureau of Political Military Affairs, which deals with U.S. arms transfers and security cooperation. In your resignation letter, you say, quote, "I could not support the provision of U.S. weapons into the conflict in Gaza, where I knew that would be used to kill thousands of civilians." Israel has been getting billions of dollars in military U.S. assistance every year, including during several episodes of war in Gaza. So what was the trigger for you this time to resign?
Thank you. Well, the difference this time was really the scale and the scope of what was unfolding before our eyes in Gaza with the weapons that we were approving. Unlike previous conflicts, which had lasted, days or a couple of weeks, by the time I resigned 10 days in, there were already almost 4,000 Palestinians dead in Gaza. And it was clear from the statements being made by Israeli government officials, as well as from the number of weapons that they continue to request and which we continue to expedite, that this would be far beyond anything we had seen before. Yet at the same time, when I raised concerns, which I had done before, about the use of American weapons in that sort of context, the use of American weapons to kill so many civilians, I was told that there was no room for any discussion or debate. It was simply our job to keep approving weapons as quickly as we could and keep getting them out of the door as quickly as I could. Faced with that disaster on the ground and the inability to debate or discuss the policy within the American government, I thought it was an important discussion for the broader American public to be having. And for that to happen, I had to resign.
Right. In a report published just now, Amnesty is calling for the U.S. military aid to Israel to be halted, saying that U.S. supplied weapons were involved in several allegations of violations of international law. This is a similar assessment reached by a group of independent experts, of which you were part. Do you think that U.S. military aid to Israel should be stopped or suspended or conditioned?
So all U.S. military aid is conditioned under law based on the recipient's practices when it comes to the human rights record of individual units and based on them not restricting the delivery of humanitarian assistance. What we see the U.S. doing now in President Biden's administration is not simply a question of policy. Should weapons be cut off? Should they be leverage used? It is the fact of them ignoring American laws that apply to arms transfers and to security assistance. So before we even get to a discussion about, you know, what should the right policy be, let us follow our own laws.
Right. According to New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman, if Israel mounts a major military operation in Rafah, in southern Gaza, where many of the Palestinians are now in dire straits, even over the administration's objection, there could be a consideration of restricting certain arms sales to Israel. Do you believe that this is really something that's being discussed and could happen?
I mean, it's certainly possible. I will believe it when I see it. At the same time, if you are concerned about the possibility of an Israeli invasion into Rafah, which is something that Prime Minister Netanyahu has said repeatedly he will do with or without, to quote, a hostage deal, then the time to cut off those weapons is now. The time to cut them off is to prevent them from being used in Rafah, not in the wake of the operation. That would just be pointless.
Right. The Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, is to report to Congress whether Israel complies with the National Security Memorandum 20, as it's known, which was issued by President Biden, whereby U.S. weapons recipients are required to prove that they will not violate international law. Israel pledged that it would abide by this. And now the State Department on Monday, April 29, said five units of the Israeli military were found to be responsible for human rights violation, but that nevertheless, they will continue to receive U.S. military backing. What does this stance mean to you?
Well, it certainly sends mixed messages, doesn't it? I think it's important to note in the context of those five units you're talking about, all of the allegations go back to the West Bank and date from well before, in some cases, several years before the current conflict. I think that's important in the one sense that it demonstrates that the U.S. is implicitly saying this did not begin on October 7th. This began many years before and has included gross violations of human rights conducted by Israeli forces for many years. When it comes to whether they will report faithfully to Congress in their upcoming report due under President Biden's memorandum, we will see. The evidence so far is that the Biden administration has repeatedly said that it does not believe that Israel is violating international humanitarian law. At the same time, the Biden administration has also given indications it will do all it can to stop international justice bodies like the International Criminal Court from holding the Israeli government and Israeli defense forces accountable. So I would be deeply skeptical that the report to Congress will provide much in the way of substance. But, you know, we must keep an open mind and we will see. The evidence is certainly manifest and is certainly there for them to report fulsomely on what has been going on.
Right. There were some indications that for the first time ever, a unit called Netzah Yehuda Battalion in Israel would be part of a withholding of U.S. aid. But you think now that this will not happen because Israel said it will provide more information? Do you think that this will be buried, essentially?
So the State Department has said that it is looking at this information. The State Department has also said the other four units it was looking at will not encounter any cutoff of assistance because they have been remediated, or in other words, that the government of Israel has addressed properly the allegations. This is not like the process I have seen for any other country or any other security force. In the typical Leahy process, this is the law that applies, the Leahy law. You know, when a gross violation of human rights is identified, assistance is cut off, and then it is a multiple years long process to identify and to work with the country to ensure that there has been proper remediation. In the case of Israel, we are relying on the Israeli military justice system to apply that remediation. And the idea that that system, the same system, by the way, which puts thousands of children into administrative detention for indefinite periods of time, is a reliable partner and is a trustworthy partner when it comes to remediating violations by those same forces is very questionable.
According to a report in The Guardian, a senior U.S. official have reviewed more than a dozen incidents of violations by Israel security forces since 2020, but ensured that the U.S. Weapons would continue to flow to the very units responsible for the allegation. This includes the death of several dual Palestinian-American, the journalist Shirin Abu Akleh, a man by the name of Omar Asad. You were involved with those discussions. Yes. Do you think the U.S. government is looking the other way or even covering up some of those crimes in order to let this aid continue to Israel?
So when it comes to U.S. citizens in particular, there is a role here not only for the vetting of the units involved in their deaths, but also for criminal investigations by the Federal Bureau of Investigation, by the Department of Justice, into the deaths of American citizens violently overseas. So where are those investigations? Where are the results of those investigations? In addition, yes, it has long been my experience, and I was part, as you say, of the process within the State Department to review allegations against Israeli security forces, a unique process, by the way, for Israel. And it is unique as well for Israel that it is the secretary who has to make these determinations. For every other country, these determinations are made at a much lower level. And yes, it was absolutely my experience that for years we toiled to bring these concerns forward, bring them up to the secretary, have these units designated under the Leahy laws, and that there was never any appetite at the political level, never any willingness at the political levels of the State Department under any administration to take action when it came to Israeli violations of human rights.
Well, this is a pretty serious allegation. This means that at a political level, there is a decision essentially to violate U.S. law.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. I think that, you know, I was made, that sort of decision is made, I think, in two ways. First of all, from very much from the top down, and we have seen that in the context of the arms transfers that we were talking about earlier, that there is just a sort of general directive to move forward. There is also a fear, I think, on the part of political appointees within the State Department, on the part of Senate-confirmed officials, that any criticism of Israel will be a career killer. We'll bring them before Congress, we'll prevent their, you know, confirmations to senior positions. And that has sort of crept down into the wit and the woof and warp of the State Department policymaking process to the extent that it is, you know, really restraining our ability to follow the law.
Right. This would explain why only very few State Department officials have resigned like you have.
So it also explains why I think there's been so little debate within the State Department. And in fact, you heard this just in the last few days from the most recent person to resign, Hala Rarit, the State Department spokesperson, Arabic language spokesperson to the Middle East, who has said that she has never in her career experienced anything like the inability to discuss and debate an issue as she has in the context of Israel in the last few months, that there has been a culture of fear within the State Department when it comes to people raising their voices on this topic.
Right. Just as a last question, U.S. campuses, at least several of them, are seeing pro-Palestinian protests. There's a lot of controversy. What does it tell you?
I mean, I think it is a significant failing of the American democratic system writ large. And then when it comes to college campuses, I think in some ways, first of all, it's a replication of what I saw in the State Department, where any concerns are just brushed aside. You know, I think we should also be very concerned because where there is one issue that we cannot speak about, there will surely be other issues to follow. And there is a very dangerous precedent being set right now. I think as well, let's be honest, you know, when it comes to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, you know, as I and many others have said for a long time, there is no military solution. There is only a political solution, and the voices have to be heard, and we have to let each other talk to each other and listen. The same is true in the American political debate. There is no policing solution here. This is a political issue, and campus administrators, rather than turning to the use of force, should be listening to their students and moving forward with their students on their concerns.
Josh Paul, that's all we have time for. I want to thank you very much for appearing here from Washington, D.C.
Well, today, a so-called town hall is being held here in Paris. Now, this is at Sciences Po University. It's like a debate, really, about the war in Gaza, that after several days ago, pro-Palestinian students occupied part of the building at Sciences Po, students then being encouraged to debate the issue. And our senior reporter, James Andre, is there for us. James, tell us what this event is all about and what the situation there is then.
Yes, well, exactly. What happened last Friday basically is that this road behind me was completely closed. This university, Sciences Politiques Paris, which is one of the main politics students university here in France, the most prestigious one, was basically occupied by students last Friday. And during this occupation, well, the management of the school was also trying to find a solution to de-escalate the situation. The government was actually intervened by the voice of Gabriel Attal, who voiced a complaint that this was happening here and said things needed to be taken into, to be calmed down. So what was negotiated on that Friday in this very building was this town hall that's taking place today. The idea is to have a debate, an honest debate, about the situation in Gaza and the Israeli current war on Hamas over there. And indeed, while the students here, the teachers, the university unions, but also some political members of the political field here in France are going to be meeting here. It is pretty tense here at Sciences Po, and the idea is to try and calm things down at a time where, indeed, there is a bit of momentum, in a sense, here in France. We saw a protest. This was Tuesday at La Sorbonne with a large Palestinian flag, and basically the thing's brewing, of course, under the influence of, as well, of what's going on the other side of the Atlantic in the United States.
That interview and report were from France 24, which may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English. They are also available at most podcast sites, as is the Shortwave Report. If you have questions or comments about the Shortwave Report or could help support this listener-funded program, you could write to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. My online support information is available there. Your donations are essential for weekly production and distribution of this show. We will conclude with Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. Israel says they are opening the Northern Erez border crossing for supplies to Palestinians. Shina Lowe of the Norwegian Refugee Council describes the real needs in Gaza. Netanyahu has told Blinken that he will not accept any notions of a permanent ceasefire and will invade Rafah. Then a report on why U.S. youth are disillusioned with the presidential election, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
Israel's military has told DW it is opening the Erez border crossing to allow more humanitarian aid to enter through northern Gaza. The first shipment of aid to use the Erez crossing is expected to arrive directly from Jordan. Israel opened the Rafah border crossing with Egypt in November and the Kerem Shalom crossing on the southern border with Israel in December. The U.S. and other countries have also been airdropping aid. And the U.S. is in the process of building a floating aid pier off Gaza's Mediterranean coast. DW's Tanya Kramer is near the Erez crossing in Gaza's north and sent us this update a little earlier.
Standing here not far away from the Erez crossing, that's one of the crossings that have been closed since October 7th, since the attacks. This crossing goes into northern Gaza, mainly. It's not very far away from Gaza City. Now, many countries have been pressuring Israel to allow in more aid, especially into northern Gaza, and the United Nations have said the situation there is a man-made crisis. Now, the opening of this crossing would allow trucks for aid and for commercial goods a shorter journey through dangerous territory while the war and, of course, air bombardment is ongoing. They could come directly from the port of Ashdod or also from Jordan through the land crossings here. But it remains to be seen how much aid will come through this crossing, how much aid will be allowed.
Shina Lowe is the communications advisor for the Norwegian Refugee Council in Jerusalem, and she explained why the crossing needs to be open.
Well, I think what we've heard, only food aid is entering through Erez. But of course, the people in northern Gaza need all sorts of additional aid, shelter items, hygiene kits, bedding, clothes, fuel, materials to desalinize and sanitize water. All of these things need to be coming in. We have been calling for months now for additional crossings to be opening, but it's not just about getting the crossings open. It's ensuring that the aid that's needed is reaching Palestinians in the quantities that will actually make a difference and help to stem and stop the humanitarian crisis that has been ongoing for the last 7 months.
Now, practically speaking, how long will it take for aid delivered through Erez to reach the people who need it?
Well, that's unclear. It depends on a variety of things. Like I said, it's not just about opening the crossings, but it's about having the ability to safely deliver aid wherever Palestinians are. And so that means ensuring that the notification system is working so that humanitarians can access Erez and also access the places that they need in order to carry out distributions. It means that we need the materials, things as simple as trucks, to be able to go, and fuel to be able to carry out those distributions. What's desperately needed is not just a handful of trucks, which we've seen very slight increases in the number of trucks entering over the last couple of weeks, but we need a massive surge, a flood of humanitarian assistance, thousands of truckloads of goods each and every day entering Gaza.
Now let's talk about the south of the Gaza Strip. Israel has struck targets in Rafah again today. What do you know about the situation there?
The situation in Rafah remains dire. There are over 1 million Palestinians still sheltering in Rafah. A planned or expected Israeli ground offensive into Rafah would be catastrophic. There simply is no safe place in Gaza for Palestinians to flee to. There aren't services available for people, water, sanitation, hygiene services, housing and shelters to accommodate an influx of people. The situation remains dire as people are searching for everything from shelter to food to water in order to keep their family alive.
Shaina Lowe there, communications advisor for the Norwegian Refugee Council in Jerusalem. Thank you. The Israeli military's confirmation comes during U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken's visit. He is meeting with Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Work continues on a ceasefire in Gaza, as well as a deal to release the hostages that are still being held by Hamas and the flow of aid into the war-torn region. It is Blinken's seventh diplomatic visit to the Middle East since Israel's military response to the Hamas terror attacks in October last year. For more, let's bring in DW correspondent Rebecca Ritters, who joins us from Jerusalem. Rebecca, what can you tell us about this meeting between Blinken and Netanyahu?
Well, these meetings tend to be closed door. There was no press conference following the meeting, but stuff that we are starting to hear come out of it, Gerhard, is that Netanyahu told Blinken that he wouldn't accept any ceasefire deal where Hamas maintain the demand for a permanent ceasefire. He said that that is something that he wouldn't agree to, and if they stuck by that demand, then the deal would be off and the Israeli military would march on into Rafah, that southern city. Now, Blinken reiterated the US position. He said that the US do not think that that is the best way forward, that they do not agree that a ground offensive in Rafah is necessary and that it would be better handled by more targeted attacks. Blinken's certainly here to push for a ceasefire deal. That's certainly one of the things that is really topping his agenda in this whole Middle East tour that he's making. As you mentioned, the seventh since October 7. The ceasefire was the predominant thing that we're hearing coming out of the meeting that the two men discussed. Blinken also praised Israel for allowing more humanitarian aid to come through, but he said more still needs to be done. I mean, it's probably no coincidence that this Erez cross is due to open today on the day that Blinken visits, given the pressure that the US has put on for Israel to get more aid into Gaza.
Washington, D.C., the heart of American government and its feverish politics. But if you ask young people here about the election these days, you get a lot of this.
not a lot of us are voting right now, and it's so important to have like the youth voice while like to be represented in like voting.
The two options aren't very timely. They don't really align with a lot of what our generation feels.
Both candidates are geriatric and they don't represent young people's values. And so I think it's hard to come to terms with which candidate to choose.
The man who ends up in White House will on a large part depend on what happens here. Georgia is a crucial swing state, even more important for Devante Jennings to get out the vote. He is chairman of the Black Caucus of the Young Democrats of Georgia. His experience this time around is sobering.
We're missing that juggernaut to get the young voters out. You know, we saw in 2008 when Barack Obama was running, everybody was so excited that people wanted to be a part of that process. There was something going on and people were excited to actually be involved with it.
This year, Devante's mission to get young people to vote may be tricky. A recent study showed only 53% of registered voters under 30 intend to vote. In the 2020 election, a record 55% of under-30s voted. The 2008 election brought out 51% of young voters. Even Devante admits that his party and President Joe Biden needs to do more to reach young voters.
Trump has no policies tailor-made for young people. And I think Biden could be, and Biden's administration could be a lot better at messaging the packages and the agendas that they do have for young people. So I think people get it misconstrued that there is none. I think there's not one on one side. One side just has to package it up and message it better.
This is Kennesaw State University. An nonpartisan group is encouraging students to vote, even if candidates may not be appealing.
Young people really care about the issues. You know, young people don't care about who's in office. They care that it's going to be somebody who actually cares about them.
Fayette County, south of Atlanta, a Republican stronghold. They are determined to work with young people even if they feel under pressure.
A lot of people are afraid to express conservative views, a lot of the young people, because they're afraid they'll be canceled on social media.
Back in Atlanta, Devante says he and the New Georgia Project volunteers, who are also encouraging people to vote, hear from young people that they care more for specific issues than candidates.
The biggest things right now, they want the issue in Gaza to be resolved, reproductive rights and cannabis.
It's still a long way to go to the November election. Only then will these volunteers see if those issues will drive young people here in swing state Georgia to go and vote.
Those reports were from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com, as well as on YouTube at their channels called DW News and DW Documentary, as well as at most podcast sites, as is the Shortwave Report. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You have to look harder these days because of US and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new Shortwave Report at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find information for online support. There's a link at my website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 28th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. For 27 years, the Shortwave Report has been produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. While I am recuperating from spinal injury, I am staying in a house that is connected to the grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.